Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Clio 2019 podcast. My name is Jake Starr, and I'll be your host for this podcast. Today, I'm very excited to welcome a very special guest, Toby Thompson. Toby is an English professor here at Penn State, as well as the author of Positively Main Street, a novel on Bob Dylan. In addition to that, he has written for a variety of magazines, including The Rolling Stone and Esquire. Toby, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Jake.
So, we're just going to kick off right away, just get into some questions and answers. So first of all, our blog Clio, or our journal Clio, our goal really is to write about the creative arts of Penn State. So how do you connect your writing to the creative arts? And in addition to that, have you ever written about the creative arts, whether it's at Penn State or elsewhere?
Well, I've written about Penn State alumni. There was an article that I did for Penn State magazine years ago about this blue-eyed soul singer named Billy Price, which was specifically related to the Penn State. But I've spent most of my career writing about the arts in one format or another. I mean, I've just completed a collection of pieces that I've of like 42 pieces that I've chosen about Western American art, whether visual art, whether music, whether writing. And these, you know, go from 1983 to the present time. You know, for a while I was a rock critic for the Washington Post back in the 70s. And my first book was a nonfiction, really kind of a new journalism book about Bob Dylan. And the reason that I picked him was that he represented to me not just music, but literature. Of course, he's come to have won the Nobel Prize for literature a couple of years ago for his songwriting, but also this less definable thing called theatricality, performing, way of presenting oneself to the world. So I've written about creativity and the arts throughout my entire creative life.
All right, so now kind of moving on a little bit now, what inspired you to kind of get into writing just in general, kind of just growing up? What were some of your interests, and kind of then what kind of led you into wanting to not just be a writer, but also be like an English professor?
Well, I was always interested in reading, and the early artistic influence on me was my uncle. He was a pioneer in 1950s television, and he came to 1950s television as a writer of skits, and he wrote skits for an early television show called Your Hit Parade, which featured the top 40 hits of the day each week. It was kind of an early version of MTV videos, except it was live. And he did many other kinds of writing projects. My early creative interests were more in music. I mean, I studied the guitar quite seriously, classical guitar, jazz guitar, and played in rock bands and on the folk circuit. It wasn't really till my latter years at college, the University of Delaware, and then in graduate school at the University of Virginia that I got interested in writing fiction. And from there, this new genre back in the late 1960s of the new journalism, which was nonfiction, which was reality, but which used the techniques of fiction to tell true stories.
All right, interesting stuff, really interesting. And so kind of just to build off of that, you talked a little bit about kind of your path, you know, your college, post-grad. How did you end up eventually getting to Penn State?
Well, let's see. I taught 1 year down at Longwood College in Virginia, and sort of enjoyed that, and then I had a year off, and I'd met this guy, Peter Schneeman, who was a teacher then at Penn State, and somehow my name came up when they were putting together this new Master of Fine Arts program, and he got in touch with me and encouraged me to apply for that position. And my writing career was starting to take off. I had published 3 books. I was writing for Esquire and other national publications, and I didn't really want a teaching job. But I thought, well, I'll apply just to see whether or not I get it. And much to my surprise, I was offered the job. And like most writers in those days, you get a job teaching and you say to yourself, I'll do it for a year. And, you know, here I am like 35 years later, still at Penn State. So for some of us, I mean, aside from the, you know, what is a kind of financial security, even though university professors don't make that much, you find that somehow teaching and talking about writing winds up supporting your writing itself, supporting your own creativity. And so you stick with it.
And I'm sure one of the exciting things about kind of teaching English is kind of seeing where your students kind of go afterwards. I'm sure, you know, kind of just seeing them grow as writers, and I'm sure it's kind of a cool thing. I'm sure in any profession, when you're a professor, seeing the kids you mentored go on and, you know, do other big things. I'm sure that you have examples of students that you've taught that have gone on to be, you know, nonfiction writers or some kind of creative writers or journalists or stuff like that, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we just had one visit campus, Vicky Glumbachy, who was an honor student who did her honors thesis with me and another person in the department. And she was way back in 1991, and she did it on the then new phenomenon of college students getting pierced. And she wrote this hilarious piece that I and another teacher encouraged her to send to Playboy magazine, which then was a kind of more a literary sort of publication that had, I don't know, 30 million readers or something like that. And she sent it off and got it published and started what has become a really successful nonfiction writing career. And her career as an editor. There are numerous other examples of that. And all of that is really satisfying. But the most satisfying is just the level of talent that I see on a yearly basis in practically every class that I teach. And I, not only do I see students improve their writing, but, I mean, from the get-go, I am reading students' work that is, you know, far better than anything that I wrote when I was their age, and some of it better than I'm writing now. You know, the general idea is that students can't write anymore, and that, you know, they don't read anymore. I mean, I find that the students who come to my classes, that's not the case whatsoever. They love to read, and they're often exceptional writers.
You brought up Vicky Glumbachy. It's interesting because she actually came and spoke to the staff of Clio a couple of weeks ago, and she told us this story about the piercings article and how you encouraged her to send it to Playboy. So it was cool kind of having her come back and visit. Is it, I guess, her or just other alums, is it kind of cool to see them come back and visit campus a lot and kind of just share their experiences with the younger writers to see, hey, if I continue to work at it, this is where I could be one day?
Yeah, it's really gratifying. And, you know, there's this old cliche about teaching, and that's that if the student doesn't wind up being a better writer than you, then the teacher has failed. And I just see that all the time. I mean, just the level of talent that develops, not necessarily because of me, I mean, in spite of me sometimes, is really, really rewarding.
So yeah, obviously you see a lot of professors kind of especially in college, you get to see the students grow as writers. And that's, I feel like that's kind of the biggest goal, right? Is to kind of see your students grow as writers and become successful outside of college. I feel like that's kind of the big goal.
Yeah, you know, and it takes a certain amount of initiative. I mean, every young writer wants to know how to get published. And you know, for the different genres, I suppose it's a little bit different. For nonfiction, you know, one of the first things I tell my students is that you've got to get out from behind your desk. You've got to find a story that, you know, particularly if you're a young writer, that's about your generation that hasn't been written yet. And I often use the example of my Bob Dylan book because, you know, I had finished a year of graduate school. I'd gotten a master's in English and didn't have the faintest idea about what I wanted to do. But I was entranced by this new genre of the new journalism, you know, which, as I said, used the techniques of fiction, which I had been studying, but was about real things. And it was the late 1960s, and culturally everything was happening that was new. And I started thinking about things that I was really interested in, generational things that I was interested in, and what person would personify that. And the person that I came up with was Bob Dylan. And he was in a period of retreat at that time, so he wasn't giving any kinds of interviews. And I thought, well, maybe I could go ride out to his hometown of Hibbing, Minnesota, and perhaps there'd be a story there. So I just packed everything up and drove out there, wound up interviewing, you know, a lot of people who were there who still knew him, found this story that hadn't been written, sent it off to a publication that then was kind of the counterculture journal, the hip journal of the day, the Village Voice. And they published this long piece in six successive issues. They serialized it. I was offered book contracts by 12 different publishers and wound up getting a book out of it, you know, when I was still 23 years old. And that doesn't happen for everybody, but it just goes to show that if you come up with the right idea at the right time, and again, get out from behind your desk and are willing to do some legwork and not just write about your own mind and your own sometimes neurotic sensibilities, that you can, you know, start fairly easily.
So you talked about kind of getting out from behind your desk and kind of getting out and doing that legwork. How much can you kind of compare that? Obviously, it's different types of writing, but take the writing aside for a second, kind of just focus on, like, the job at hand. How much can you kind of compare to, like, what you did with Bob Dylan and, like, what a regular journalist does when they have to get out and do write and report on a story, kind of getting out from their own desk? Hell, do you see parallels between those two professions right there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I believe that reporting, asking people questions and doing research is necessary for any piece of writing that you do. Even if you're writing memoir about yourself, that you know, if you're writing about yourself, I mean, you have an idea of what your experience is or was or what happened in the incident that you might be describing in this memoir piece. But there are all these other people who might have been there who have other ideas about it or can amplify your thoughts. So reporting even in a memoir piece is really important. And the kind of reporting that somebody might do when they are reporting on a football game or the World Series, for example, often says as much about them and their sensibility as it does about the event that they're reporting upon. It's one of the reasons that, for example, sports columnists are faithfully read. They want to see how, if you're reading the Washington Post about the World Series, I mean, you want to see what Tom Boswell has to say about it, as opposed to, you know, another reporter who might be reporting on the same event. It's a person's take that becomes important, even though the facts of that event are the same. And, you know, my belief also is that even if you're reporting on a story like a sports event, for example, you have to use your own subconscious too. You have to trust your subconscious, as the writer's subconscious, to shape the material and to help you focus it, because otherwise you've just got a list of things that happen. So whether you're writing fiction, whether you're writing poetry, whether you're writing nonfiction, you're also depending upon what the nonfictionist and fiction writer Norman Mailer, for example, called the navigator. The navigator being that part of your subconscious that is controlling the writing, controlling what, you know, comes out the end of your fingers onto the page.
All right, so yeah, interesting. And obviously, I think the big point you made there, especially in sports or this event, if you're covering it kind of as a journalist, it's like the facts are the facts. Like, whatever happened, happened. But the real goal, I think, where you kind of separate the good from the great writers is the ones that can kind of, you know, find a different angle or find how people feel or, like, just find a way to distinguish and make it stand out from it just being any old football game or any old baseball game and stuff like that.
Yeah, and when you're, and, you know, I believe, I do write a lot of profiles, which is a short biographical portrait of somebody, and one of the pieces that I teach in my introductory classes is a piece that Gage Elise wrote back in the early 1960s about the former heavyweight champion of the world, Floyd Patterson. And that piece, it's called The Loser, which is an odd title for a piece about somebody who's a professional boxer who's training for a fight. But what Talese saw in Patterson, who was trying to regain his heavyweight championship from the then heavyweight champion Sonny Liston, what Talese saw was in Patterson was the fact that he seemed to get more pleasure out of losing than winning, which is not a great attribute for success in somebody who's a professional fighter. But not cover just an event of Patterson fighting in the ring, but to follow him through training camp, hang around with him during training camp, and show that side, very human side of his personality.
All right, so to backtrack a little bit, you talked about Positively Main Street, your book on Bob Dylan. Is that the piece of writing you're most proud of, or do you think there's something else you're most proud of, or do you have a lot of things you're proud of?
I think that book, even though I wrote it when I was 23, 24 years old, and knew absolutely or very little about nonfiction writing, it has a kind of energy to it, despite its youthfulness and its naivete, that has caused that book to stay in print now for almost 50 years. And hardcore, it was the first real book that was written about Bob Dylan. And so it got, you know, a lot of attention. And even now, hardcore Dylan fans who have read practically every book that's been written about him, and I've heard that there are like about 1,000 books about Bob Dylan that they look at, they love that book because it captures the enthusiasm of a young fan and also writes about Dylan's enthusiasm as a young performer trying to escape from his hometown of Hibbing, Minnesota and make it to the big time, first in Minneapolis, where he was going to college, and then later on to Greenwich Village.
And I know I took your English 215 class last semester. I know one of our first assignments was to read that book. Is there a specific reason why you want students to start out by reading that book? Is there a lesson they can take away with it? Is there a style point? Is there something in there that you want them to see when then they go and write their own nonfiction pieces that they can kind of take away from that novel?
Yeah, I think that that the youthful enthusiasm is part of it. That the use of colloquial language, everyday language, slang, is acceptable in that kind of genre. You don't have to write formally like you've been taught since fourth grade or whatever. And also that narrative is really important. If you're writing about yourself, you need to create yourself as a character. You can't just use the word I. You have to use scenes to describe who you are, to demonstrate who you are. And again, you have to get out from behind your desk to, you know, find out stuff that nobody else has found out about the person you're writing about. Because Positively Main Street is, you know, I mean, it's essentially a biographical piece of writing.
So now, kind of moving on a little bit, we're going to kind of stick on this same notion about the biographical writing, the nonfiction writing. I know it's hard to pinpoint just one, but what's one or two or a couple or a few keys that produce quality nonfiction writing, you think?
The first thing you've got to do is to come up with a good story. And, you know, that's something that's hard to teach. Maybe it's impossible to teach. The best writer, we were talking about Vicki Glimbacki. The best nonfiction writers of magazine pieces and of books are ones who are able to spot a new trend, spot something that hasn't been written about before, or that hasn't been written about in a way that they have an idea to write about it, and also to see things within themselves that they can write in a special, unique way. Obviously, basic things, talent, innate kind of talent for writing that's necessary for success, obviously. The ability to do to talk to other people, to report, to be a good listener, not just an interrogator, the way a lot of investigative journalists are, but to be somebody who's genuinely interested in other people is a trait that I think is really important too. Those are just a couple.
Yeah, definitely a lot of good keys there, a lot of good pieces of advice. So I'm going to move on as we begin to wrap this up a little bit. Talk about you a little bit. Just kind of, you've been doing this for a long time, and you're still doing it. So what inspires you to keep doing what you do?
You know, I suppose an interest in the subjects that I come up with. I mean, I'll give you an example. I spend summers out in Montana, and a guy from Montana came out with a new book about Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway used to spend summers in Montana and Wyoming back in the 1930s, and this guy came out with a book about Ernest Hemingway in the Yellowstone High Country is what it's called. And so I didn't know about it, but there's this tiny little town called Cook City where Hemingway used to, you know, live, population 100. And I was down there, you know, hiking this summer, and I ran across this guy's book, and it turned out that he was the bartender of a saloon in this tiny town of Cook City, Montana, where Hemingway used to hang out. And he had written this book that was getting a lot of attention. And it turned out that he had written a paper or a story for the Hemingway Society, which is this big international society, and had been invited to Paris, France, the previous summer to give this paper about Hemingway in the Yellowstone High Country. And he talked these scholars, including Sandy Spanier, who's part of our English department here, into having this year's Hemingway Society meeting in this tiny town of Cook City, Montana. So I went over to the Miner's Saloon to find this guy to talk to him. And I walked into the bar, and you know, this stocky guy was leaning on a mop, and he said, "We're not closed. We're closed now. We're not going to open until noon." And I said, "You know, I'm Toby Thompson." And I'm, "Oh, Toby, yeah." And he introduced himself as the author. And we started talking. And I was talking to this guy who had written this important book, and he was swamping out the bar with a mop. He'd just finished swamping out the toilets of this saloon and was swamping the floors of this bar, talking to me about Ernest Hemingway and the meeting of this august Hemingway Society the next summer. And I thought to myself, that's a story. You know, this guy is a story. The idea of these, you know, Tweedy professors descending upon this raucous town in the middle of Montana nowhere for this next year's Hemingway Society meeting is a story that I want to write about, and this guy is going to be the center of the story, and all because I caught him leaning on a mop swamping out a saloon in Cook City.
Yeah, it's always like those interesting little things. I remember you talked to us about it last semester, just about, you know, point out the little things. Like if you write the entire story and you fail to acknowledge the fact that he was mopping the floor, it's you're missing out on the biggest point of the story.
Well, the hook grabber or the hook, you know, I mean, everybody's going to be interested in that visual image.
So kind of wrapping it all up now, we're getting close to the end here. Just last question as a parting message, kind of, what pieces of advice do you have for all those young, inspiring writers out there? Like the ones reading Clio, the ones that are going to submit to us, the ones that you have, or the other ones that are taking English classes here at Penn State?
Well, I mean, if you're a young writer and you're doing any of those things that were just mentioned, then you're already thinking about being a writer, or you're practicing being a writer. I would say at Penn State, take as many classes as you can with the teachers that seem to be teaching writing on your wavelength or the way that you see the world. Stretch a little bit and try a genre, perhaps. Like if you're a poet, try nonfiction to see how you do it that and how that might, in fact, improve your poetry. And, you know, use the company of other writers. I mean, you have workshops if you're taking creative writing classes where you're part of a writing group. But, you know, even when you finish your undergraduate career or even your graduate career, find a writing group, a reading group where you can, you know, share your manuscripts, get feedback, have support, so that you don't feel like you're, you know, constantly working in a vacuum.
All right, so really good advice. I think a lot of the young writers can kind of take that and something they can run with. So anybody that, you know, is listening to this, somebody that's been reading Clio, or just any English student out there, definitely something worth listening to. Well, that's going to pretty much about wrap it up. Toby, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today. It was really a pleasure to get the opportunity to talk to you, and just thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jake. It's my pleasure.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. And on behalf of our entire Clio 2019 team, I'm Jake Starr. You've been listening to the Clio 2019 podcast.